Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. We're going to talk about journaling, inspiring altruism through an attitude of gratitude. This University of Oregon. We're also going to take a look at it's time to retire cholesterol testing. One person's arguing there is no such thing as bad cholesterol. And that's from Prevent Disease and a lot more on health and healing. I didn't have a chance yesterday to deal with Chris Hedges as the bankruptcy of the American left. I will today from Truth Dig. Also today, we'll be taking a look at two stories. They were not in the same publication. One's The Intercept about how Secretary of State Colin Powell knew or should have known that the information he was giving was wrong. And then we have from Ben Norton a transcript that I just read of Powell's top assistant. And that person is saying, quote, we are the death merchant of the world. Lawrence Borkerson is saying that. And he knew that what Powell was using was misinformation. Well, why did Powell use it? So this is going to change for those who care about history and who is really responsible for, in effect, genocide. It will change perspective of Colin Powell. So I'll share that with you. Also, new information has been coming out this morning showing that behind this whole Russian gate is actually Clinton gate, that all of the media and certainly the top people in the Justice Department, including the Attorney General, the Assistant Attorney General, and Deputy Attorney General, the head of the FBI, and at least 10 top people in the FBI all knew that the information that they were using to try to challenge Trump's first his election and then his presidency was bogus. But they never felt that that would be undone. It has been. And now this whole conspiracy leads right up to President Obama, because one of the top people in the FBI has sent memos, and in the memo, it says, she says, the president, or POTUS, wants to be kept aware of everything. So, why would she say that if it weren't true? Now, of course, everyone will try to protect the Clintons, but why should they? Long ago, the corporatized Democratic Party lost its legitimacy to be a party of the people. More than ever, we need a third party. We need a party of people who do not want to be the pawns in this game of being a Democrat or Republican, because they're both controlled by the same outside sources. I'm going to go a little further today in explaining why Clinton would have made probably the worst and most dangerous president in American history, and why she should not be protected at this time. And then I have a guest in the second part of our program. You haven't heard from her. She has a lot of experience, 35 years of experience, as a board-certified pediatrician. She is Dr. Michelle Perreault, P-E-R-R-O. And she's going to talk about the epidemic of childhood illnesses due to our agrochemical food industry. So I'm going to ask her about, is this the new silent spring? Are GMOs, which are a boon for the pharmaceutical industry with all their hormones, antibiotics, and pesticides, and toxins all coming through our food, are these responsible for so many of the conditions we're seeing in our children? That'll be an interesting interview. And we're going to play the segment I didn't have a chance to yesterday on, a millennial talking about the problems and solutions for millennials. At the end of the program, I'll give you a chance to call in and share your thoughts on that. Our talkback number is 888-874-4888. And I want to thank the more than 1,000 people who are listening now on their cell phones using the app. And the app you can find for PRN.FM by going to the store on your cell phone and just see PRN.FM app. That way, anywhere you go, anytime, for live or archives, you're in touch. So as you see, we have quite a program lined up today. I'll make each of the segments a little shorter than normal to try to get it all in. I believe that we all have moments in our lives where we would like to, or have been, filled with a sense of inspired altruism. I believe that that comes from growing up where our parents and grandparents and others taught us the significance of gratitude. Now, gratitude does more than help maintain good health. New research at the University of Oregon finds that regularly noting feelings of gratitude in a journal leads to increased altruism. And the study is published in the journal Frontiers in Human Neuroscience, and it sought to determine whether personal altruistic traits could be increased with a writing intervention. And I was working on this years ago, where I asked people, I remember the first time was 1972, at a retreat I did up at the Healing Fertler Farm up in Stone Ridge. And I wanted to try something new. I asked the people, would they agree, if this was just for a weekend, Friday night, Saturday, and Sunday, would they agree not to talk? Instead, outside of doing yoga and exercising in the morning, just to spend time journaling, and specifically journaling about the things that they felt grateful for. And they did, about 50 people. And then on Sunday afternoon, each person was given an opportunity to share their thoughts and what they observed about themselves. And it was very revealing. It was cathartic for some people. As one young man said, he was only about 25 years old. He said, I've never journaled in my life, and I'm very hyper. I rarely can sit still. My attention span goes all over the place. So I didn't think this would be possible, but I wrote all this stuff down, and then it just started to flow. So one of the things that we can do is spend more quality time in silence and reflecting in a positive way about what we have to feel grateful for. And then pass it on. Then look at, if we have a gift, give a gift. If we're able to appreciate what has been given to us in life, if we don't take everything for granted, if we don't feel entitled about everything, if we don't show up and just expect it to be, you know, adored and appreciated like a lot of young people do, yet you've done nothing. Because one of the things that all of us who are baby boomers, at least, and older, have learned, you should make every effort possible to show, through your contributions to the greater society and individuals, that your life has meaning. There is a real purpose, not just collection of money or succeeding or goals, but rather how you touch other people, the fact that you care about other people who may be in need, the fact that you're willing to take time and energy for other people. And that comes from that sense of gratitude. I remember my mother telling me that during the Great Depression, she lived on a farm, and she had food. My great aunt who lived there was a disciplinarian. I liked her. No one else did. In fact, nobody ever wanted to go over the farm to see her, and I did. And she had a good sense of humor. She was a vegan. She was very generous, and half of everything she ever grew or made, she gave to those who had less. And I once asked her, I said, what are you doing for all this stuff? And she said, oh, this is more than what I can eat. She said, but I'm thinking about all the people who don't have the advantage of having a farm. So if I make more than what I need, then I have a moral responsibility to share that with others. That had an enormous impact on me, more than anything else any of my other family members or aunts and uncles had ever delved into. So I'm sure many of you understand, if you were really, I would say, blessed and gifted to have parents who grew up in the Great Depression, as a society, we held together because people cared about one another. Now, there are people today who care about others and do a lot of wonderful charity work, and I really commend those people. I can't tell you how much respect I have for you when you go out of your way to do something to help lighten the burden of other people, showing up and working at a homeless kitchen, doing the things that make a difference. Anyhow, it's just a study I thought was important, but it requires sitting quietly, journaling, and looking and reading what you're grateful for, and then passing it forward. From PreventDisease.com, I read an interesting story. It's talking about how about 50%, half of all of Americans, have cholesterol levels that fall outside the accepted health range. But who defines this range and under what testing protocols? They're asking this question. Now, many medical professionals are starting to question the current standard of care when it comes to statin therapy, as these cholesterol-lowering medications are not good for you. In fact, they do a great deal of harm. But mainstream medicine has long supported the message that HDL cholesterol is good and LDL cholesterol is bad. However, that may be an oversimplification. Why? Because LDL, the so-called bad cholesterol, is indeed needed by the body to build new muscle. And the older you get, the less muscle you lay down, so you need more muscle as you age. And LDL can protect the brain as we age, and low levels of it can escalate problems such as dementia and memory loss. Cholesterol is neither good nor bad, this person is saying. In effect, they're saying that artificial attempts to lower your cholesterol can actually be harmful. They talked about the Dr. Harlan, H-A-R-L-A-N, Krumsholt, K-R-U-M-H-O-L-Z, of the Department of Cardiovascular Medicine at Yale University, who reported in the Journal of the American Medical Association that old people with low cholesterol died twice as often from a heart attack as did old people with high cholesterol. Now, most people are not aware of this. Most cardiologists are not aware of it. I know I'm in the process, even as we speak, of filming a group of cardiologists, and I'm finding that they are out of the loop when it comes to understanding any of the things that you hear on a regular basis. They only go to the scientific literature that supports use statin drugs and lower your cholesterol. So supporters of cholesterol campaigns who routinely provide disinformation about LDL cholesterol consistently ignore this observation, or consider it a rare exception produced by chance among a number of studies, but that's not true. In fact, it's not an exception. There are now a large number of findings that contradict the lipid hypothesis. And to be more specific, most studies on the elderly have shown that high cholesterol is not a risk factor for coronary heart disease on the Medline database. Many studies address that question specifically on how high cholesterol may protect against infections and atherosclerosis. And dozens of studies from peer-reviewed literature have found that high cholesterol does not predict or cause death. Now, consider that more than 90% of all cardiovascular disease is seen in people above the age of 60, and also that almost all studies have found that high cholesterol is not a risk factor for women. This means that high cholesterol is only a risk factor for about 5% of those who die from a heart attack. So then I believe we're at a point where we must have open national debates about testing people for LDL, and if they're elevated, immediately putting them on statins to bring it down without looking at all the other possible circumstances. Because it is not difficult to make a strong argument that we have been misled on the cholesterol issue. And if you doubt me, look at all the information, misinformation, wrong information, and deadly information we got about eating margarine when it was the butter that was better than the margarine. So, something to think about. From Copenhagen University comes a study about young diabetics could have 700% risk of sudden cardiac death. When I was recently in Orlando, and I was near Disneyland, or Disney World, I was just standing there with a physician that I was speaking with, watching people go into the gate. I would say 90% of the people who went through there were overweight, and especially the children. And then you look at all the junk food that they eat. We have an epidemic of diabetes, adult diabetes, in children, arthritis, heart disease, and overweight in children. Now, the study that I'm referring to points to the importance of early and ongoing heart monitoring in children and young adults with diabetes. And, quote, I think parents are probably already aware of their children's symptoms and pains, so this message is more for doctors about more cardiac monitoring. Children and young adults who have had a sudden cardiac death often have had symptoms of chest pains or fainting beforehand. When you have a young person with diabetes, you should be aware that this person has a higher risk of heart disease, even though they are young, even with type 1 diabetes. Now, this audience knows that diabetes is a blood disorder. It's also called blood glucose disorder, meaning you have too high glucose, blood sugar. Glucose from food is the body's main source of energy and is regulated by insulin and a hormone that's made by your pancreas. Well, soft drinks and caffeine really play havoc with your pancreas. Fructose and sugar also does the same. A high-protein meat diet does the same. So over time, diabetes can cause a host of health problems, including damage to blood vessels and nerves, and such as those that control the heart and blood vessels. Now, type 1 diabetes occurs most often in children and young adults and is caused by the immune system attacking insulin-producing cells in the pancreas. Type 2 diabetes is diagnosed at an age, it can be anywhere, by the way, from 3 years on up. And it occurs when there isn't enough insulin or when the body doesn't use it well. Now, this can be caused by a sedentary lifestyle, being overweight, having high blood pressure. All of these increase the risk of type 2 diabetes. So just listen to what I'm saying, please. How you deal with it is your business. But between diabetes and prediabetes, you're dealing with 100 million Americans, about 30% of the entire American population. And guess what comes with that? A high risk of premature death. So I think that we should start to pay attention. Now, for those of us who actually reverse it and get people who are no longer diabetic, and I remember the guy I brought on the show once, Fred Fisher. Heck of a nice guy. Fred was one of those easygoing guys, lived over in Brooklyn, and he was depressed, and so deal with his depression and low self-esteem because he was always overweight. He would just keep eating. And at one point when I got a call from Fred, he said, I've got one of two choices. The doctor, my cardiologist, says that I must have surgery because I've got congestive heart failure. But he said, at my age, 55, if I have that, I have a 95% chance of dying on the operating table. I said, well, that's a very high statistic. I mean, that would only be true if you were morbidly obese. He said, oh, I'm beyond that. I'm 727 pounds. Whoa. So I said, what is it you're asking from me? He said, is there anything you can think of? Because I told the doc I was going to postpone the surgery for a couple weeks, and if I didn't get better, I'd go ahead and do the surgery and risk. So I immediately put Fred on a program, and he stuck with it just as strictly as you could. He'd walk out and get fresh juice, and over the next year, Fred lost, actually a year and a half, Fred lost 347 pounds. A blood sugar level of 500 came down to about 80. Blood pressure normal. No more congestive heart failure. No more arthritis in the knees. In fact, he appeared with me on a PBS special, and he held up his belt. And I'm 6'1", and the belt was taller than me. I mean, it's just amazing. If you saw that special, you saw Fred. Fred went on to live an additional 20 years, and which in and of itself is remarkable. And so, and I spoke to him about a year before he passed. So the question is, how cavalier are we, or how indifferent are we when we have obesity or high blood pressure or high blood sugar? And what if you have all three? Then you're really risking sudden cardiac death. And the reason that happens is because sudden cardiac death is triggered by an electrical malfunction in the heart that causes it to beat irregularly. And it can happen abruptly and without warning. And once the heart's pumping action is disrupted and blood can't reach the brain and lungs and other organs, the person loses consciousness and has no pulse. Death is generally within minutes without treatment. And this year, we'll have over 350,000 to 400,000 Americans have a cardiac arrest outside of a hospital. Only 1 in 10 survives. So I want people to live a longer life. I don't want them ending up getting themselves in a bad situation. So don't overlook these things. Whatever help you need, whatever support you need, please get it so you're going to live a longer life. Back in a moment with a commentary from Chris Hedges. Please stay with us.
I've heard people say that too much of anything is not good for you, baby. But I don't know about that. There's many times that we've loved and we've shared love and made love. It doesn't seem to me like it's enough. It's just not enough, man. It's just not enough.
There will be no economic or political justice for the poor, people of color, the vast majority of women, or the rank-and-file workers within the framework of global and corporate capitalism. Now, I mentioned yesterday that Obama made all these promises and betrayed us on every single one. But because of his charm factor, because of our cognitive disconnect, he did all this before the second election and still got a landslide election. Clinton was no different. What's in it? What is it within us that when someone betrays us, they lie to us, they use us, they abuse us, but they do so with charm, that we just go into the state of denialism? The entire left, except for the progressive wing, is in complete denialism. Corporate capitalism, which I call vulture capitalism, which uses identity politics and multiculturalism and racial justice to masquerade as politics, will never halt the rising social inequality and unchecked militarism and evisceration of our civil liberties and the omnipotence of the organs of security and surveillance state. We're seeing that now. And I want to thank Chris Hedges for his article in Truth dig the bankruptcy of the American left for bringing this to our attention. I've said it before, I'll say it again. Corporate capitalism, the Democrat and Republican Party cannot, will not, never be reformed. So please stop following the Pied Piper, Bernie Sanders, into that ethereal domain of believing that he is capable of changing the Democratic Party. He is a part of that party. The difference is that he is smart enough to support certain domestic issues, rightly so, but on all other issues, he is Hillary Clinton light. Corporate capitalism constantly tries to rebrand itself. The longer the self-identified left and liberal class seek to work within a system that the political philosopher Sheldon Wolin calls inverted totalitarianism, the more the noose will be tightened around our necks. If we do not rise up to bring government and financial systems under public control, which includes nationalizing the banks and nationalizing the fossil fuel industry, and quite simply stopping the arms industry, we will continue all to be victims. I have said it many times, we should not have any corporation have the ability to profit under their own control from any quality of life issue, meaning water and gas and land, food, the things that are essential for our well-being should never be in the power of a corporatocracy. It should be in public power. And why do we need an arms industry? So that 200,000 private and corporate contractors representing about 5.2 million employees can then give their thanks to politicians for boondoggle, corrupt, wasteful, duplicitous projects? Yeah. I would be completely supportive of the idea of helping subsidize the training of these 5.2 million people to go into other fields, including infrastructure renewal and other quality of life, programs, so there's a transition, so they just wouldn't end up unemployed. We're not even having that conversation. We should understand that corporate capitalism is supranational. It owes no loyalty to any nation state. It uses the projection of military power by the United States to protect and advance its economic interest, but at the same time cannibalizes the U.S., dismantling its democratic institutions and allowing its infrastructure to decay and deindustrializing its factory centers to ship manufacturer products abroad. And there, those workers are treated as serfs. So resistance to this global cabal of corporate oligarchs must also be, it must be focused. It must build alliances with workers around the globe. It must defy all liberal institutions, including the Democratic Party, the most corrupt, vile, fascistic party right now and has been for some time. It just has a prettier face put on it. But in the reality, the Democratic Party betrayed workers, betrayed the environment, betrayed the Constitution, betrayed all of our Bill of Rights. It is this betrayal that has given rise to fascistic and proto-fascist movements in Europe and other countries. And Donald Trump would never have been elected, I've said this many times on this program, if it were not for the betrayal of the liberal community. You have only yourself to blame for Donald Trump. Donald Trump is such a dimwit. He is so ignorant. He is so classless. He is such a retard that he couldn't get himself into a movie theater even if he wanted to pay twice the price of a ticket. But all the things you promised and then lied about opened the door for them seeking someone else. So we need to build a global movement powerful enough to bring down corporate capitalism or witness the rise of a new, even more fierce totalitarianism. The left, seduced by the culture wars and identity politics, largely ignores the primacy of capitalism in the class struggle. As long as unregulated capitalism reigns supreme, all socioeconomic, cultural, and political change will be cosmetic. Capitalism at its core is about the commodification of human beings and the natural war for exploitation and profit. To increase profit, it constantly seeks to reduce the cost of labor and demolish the regulations and laws that protect the common good. But as capitalism ravages the social fabric, it damages, like any parasite, the host that allows it to exist. It unleashes dark, uncontrollable yearnings among an enraged population that threatens capitalism itself. Yeah. Our society today is like a social powder keg. There's an anger that exists over working conditions and social inequality, however much they may be confused by these issues. Workers in this country have a deep belief in democratic rights. We totally reject the narrative that the working class is racist. Boy, was that stupid. God, did the left leave its brains in a toilet? Did you defecate them out? What were you thinking when you allowed Hillary Clinton to go unchallenged when she said, these are all deplorables? You're going to call tens of millions of Americans deplorable when you've never once spent 1 minute talking with them, living in their homes, eating their the food that they make, seeing what they have to deal with in a given day? How dare you? You do not deserve the moniker of true liberalism. You're acting more like neo-fascists. But that's what the Clintons did, and the Obamas did, and Bushes did, and Reagans did, and Ford did. The only one who didn't was Carter and Eisenhower. Truman was no better. You'd have to go way back to FDR to find someone who truly represented ideals against his own class that allowed us to get out of the Great Depression. But today, I can't watch CNN. I can't watch MSNBC. I can't watch these propagandists. I can't watch people who have intellects and abuse the right. All we have in our society is a loss of intersectionality. Instead of focusing on the plight of all of the oppressed and oppressed groups, began to seek representation for their own members within capitalist structures. That's a big mistake. So those who have found themselves outside of being helped are now looking for a way to be inside and have something that represents them. We've seen this with the Sheryl Sandberg, the COO of Facebook. She did a third wave feminism thing. She said, lean in. It captures this identity politics that has become toxic on the left. And what does lean in mean? It means women should lean in and go as far as they can in the corporation. They should become, as she has, the major wealthy executive of a leading corporation. And when feminism was turned into that kind of leaning in, it created an identity politics that legitimizes the very system that needs to be critiqued. The early feminists were overtly socialist. The new ones, they're part of this lean-in fascistic movement. The left has become kind of a grab bag of discrete, siloed identity movements. And that's unfortunate. Now we're going to go directly, before we go to my guest, I want you to hear this. I promise this, and I think this is very enlightening. Millennials in the Workforce, A Generation of Weakness by Simon Sinek.
What's the millennial question? Apparently, millennials as a generation, which is a group of people who were born approximately 1984 and after, are tough to manage. And they're accused of being entitled and narcissistic and self-interested, unfocused, lazy. But entitled is the big one. And because they confound leadership so much, what's happening is leaders are asking the millennials, what do you want? And millennials are saying, we want to work in a place with purpose. Love that. We want to make an impact, you know, whatever that means. We want free food and beanbags. And so somebody articulates some sort of purpose. There's lots of free food and there's beanbags. And yet, for some reason, they're still not happy. And that's because they're missing, there's a missing piece. What I've learned is that there, I can break it down into four pieces, right? There are four things, four characteristics. One is parenting. The other one is technology. The third is impatience. And the fourth is environment. The generation that we call the millennials, too many of them grew up subject to, not my words, failed parenting strategies, you know, where, for example, they were told that they were special all the time. They were told that they could have anything they want in life just because they want it, right? They were told, some of them got into honors classes not because they deserved it, but because their parents complained. And some of them got A's not because they earned them, but because the teachers didn't want to deal with the parents. Some kids got participation medals. They got a medal for coming in last, right? Which the science we know is pretty clear, which is it devalues the medal and the reward for those who actually work hard. And that actually makes the person who comes in last feel embarrassed because they know they didn't deserve it. So it actually makes them feel worse, right? So you take this group of people and they graduate school and they get a job and they're thrust into the real world. And in an instant, they find out they're not special. Their moms can't get them a promotion. That you get nothing for coming in last. And by the way, you can't just have it because you want it. Right? And in an instant, their entire self-image is shattered. And so you have an entire generation that's growing up with lower self-esteem than previous generations. The other problem, to compound it, is we're growing up in a Facebook, Instagram world. In other words, we're good at putting filters on things. We're good at showing people that life is amazing even though I'm depressed. Right? And so everybody sounds tough. And everybody sounds like they got it all figured out. And the reality is there's very little toughness and most people don't have it figured out. And so when the more senior people say, well, what should we do? They sound like, this is what you got to do. And they have no clue. Right? So you have an entire generation growing up with lower self-esteem than previous generations, right? Through no fault of their own. Through no fault of their own, right? They were dealt a bad hand, right? Now let's add in technology. We know that engagement with social media and our cell phones releases a chemical called dopamine. That's why when you get a text, it feels good, right? So, you know, we've all had it where you're feeling a little bit down or feeling a bit lonely. And so you send out 10 texts to 10 friends, you know, hi, 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 hi. Because it feels good when you get a response, right? Right? It's why we count the likes. It's why we go back 10 times to see if, and if it's going, if our, my Instagram is growing slower, did I do something wrong? Do they not like me anymore, right? The trauma for young kids to be unfriended, right? Because we know when you get a hit of dopamine, which feels good. It's why we like it. It's why we keep going back to it. Dopamine is the exact same chemical that makes us feel good when we smoke, when we drink, and when we gamble. In other words, it's highly, highly addictive. Right? We have age restrictions on smoking, gambling, and alcohol, and we have no age restrictions on social media and cell phones, which is the equivalent of opening up the liquor cabinet and saying to our teenagers, hey, by the way, this adolescence thing, if it gets you down. But that's basically what's happening. That's basically what's happening, right? That's basically what happened. You have an entire generation that has access to an addictive, numbing chemical called dopamine through social media and cell phones as they're going through the high stress of adolescence. Why is this important? Almost every alcoholic discovered alcohol when they were teenagers. When we're very, very young, the only approval we need is the approval of our parents. And as we go through adolescence, we make this transition where we now need the approval of our peers. Very frustrating for our parents, very important for us. It allows us to acculturate outside of our immediate families into the broader tribe. Right? It's a highly, highly stressful and anxious period of our lives, and we're supposed to learn to rely on our friends. Some people, quite by accident, discover alcohol and numbing effects of dopamine to help them cope with the stresses and anxieties of adolescence. Unfortunately, that becomes hardwired in their brains, and for the rest of their lives, when they suffer significant stress, they will not turn to a person, they will turn to the bottle. Social stress, financial stress, career stress. That's pretty much the primary reasons why an alcoholic drinks, right? What's happening is because we're allowing unfettered access to these dopamine-producing devices and media, basically it's becoming hardwired. And what we're seeing is as they grow older, too many kids don't know how to form deep, meaningful relationships. Their words, not mine. They will admit that many of their friendships are superficial. They will admit that their friends, that they don't count on their friends, they don't rely on their friends, they have fun with their friends, but they also know that their friends will cancel on them if something better comes along. Deep, meaningful relationships are not there because they never practice the skill set, and worse, they don't have the coping mechanisms to deal with stress. So when significant stress starts to show up in their lives, they're not turning to a person, they're turning to a device, they're turning to social media, they're turning to these things which offer temporary relief. We know, the science is clear, we know that people who spend more time on Facebook suffer higher rates of depression than people who spend less time on Facebook. Right? These things balance. Alcohol is not bad.
Now, we're going to come back to the second part of this tomorrow. That was just 7 minutes. There's another 7 minutes to go. But I also promised you an in-depth conversation with Dr. Michelle Perreault. She is on the phone now from Green Brea, California. I gave you her background a little earlier, where she is a board-certified pediatrician of 35 years in acute and integrative medicine. And during the past decade, her clinical practice has dealt more with pesticide and food health advocacy. And recently, she's become an important voice warning the public about GMO foods and food toxins and pesticides and their health risks. And Michelle has been both a director and physician at New York's Metropolitan Hospital, as well as University of California, San Francisco Children's Hospital in Oakland. And she ran Down to Earth Pediatrics, a holistic urgent care clinic for children, and more recently as an integrative physician at the Institute for Health and Healing at Sutter Pacific Medical Center, Sacramento. She's author of a new book, actually co-written with Dr. Vince Caney Adams, a professor of medical anthropology, University of California at San Francisco, called What's Making Our Children Sick?, which explores the link between chronic illness, GMO foods, glyphosate, or Roundup, and gut disorders. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
You've called our poisoned industrial foods that our government allows our citizens to consume as the second Silent Spring. And I would certainly concur that the foods we purchase at our local grocery markets are making our society extremely ill. Of course, I would also add that another downside is that all these food-related illnesses due to toxins and pesticides and antibiotics and hormones and GMOs are a boon for the pharmaceutical profit centers. And this is an industry that profits off diseases, even profits off death, but never profits off preventing illness and sustaining health. And personally, I would not make this statement without also including the schedule of the different vaccines as a part of this. It's synergistic. Also, except for the failure of our health agencies to acknowledge it, the scientific evidence is closed that agricultural pesticides and foods are a serious health risk. We've known this for decades. Roundup or glyphosate is not just suspected carcinogen, it's a carcinogen. But one of the areas that is still not as conclusive is the health risk of the genetically modified foods themselves and the disorders they are contributing to, especially among children who consume the standard GMO-tainted foods in the average American diet, such as BT gene in GMO foods come to mind. So I would like for you to share with us the scientific case for the health dangers inherent in genetically modified seeds and crops, and now fruits and vegetables. The forum is yours.
Thank you so much. I'd be happy to address that because I myself have asked that very question. Is it a problem with the genetic modified process? Is it that process and the associated glyphosate? And is it the process, the glyphosate, and with the Roundup, which is a more complicated formula and a more toxic formula? So when we look back at the GM process, it was first studied by Dr. Arpad Pusti in in the UK, and he was actually at a place called the Rowett Institute. He was a plant biologist who studied natural plant insecticides called lectins. And he was asked to look at this issue before bringing this food into Europe. He created a study. It took him 3 years to develop it. He was a meticulous, he still is alive, researcher. And he studied specifically the genetic modified potato on rats. And he did devised a beautiful and very simple study looking at genetically, they were called GNA potatoes, genetically modified potatoes to rats that were fed that product and those that were fed regular rat chow. And what he found, he did not suspect that there would be a problem. But what he found, and this is already 22 years ago, was that the rats who ate the genetic modified potatoes had significant health disorders, ranging from immune dysfunction, organ dysfunction, both on endocrine-producing organs such as the pancreas, changes in the liver, atrophy, testes. But in addition, and this is something Vincent and I really hone in on the book, were gut findings. And what he found were disruptions of the intestinal villi, which are the little absorptive fingers that line your intestinal wall that are responsible for absorption of nutrients, as well as keeping out various toxins and toxicants out of our bloodstream. And when I looked at those villi on histopathology slides and I saw those disruptions, I made a clinical correlation that was an excellent contributor to what we call leaky gut or intestinal permeability. And that was my first light bulb, Gary, going off about this, and this was for me back in 2006. That's how long I've been at this question. So one would have thought that Dr. Pusty, when he came out to the BBC about this, that, you know, he would have been a hero. He was decorated. For the first 2 days after this news leaked about what, you know, he reported it, he was a hero, the presses were all over him, and then promptly he was fired. Bill makes a call to Tony. Tony calls the Rowett, and before you know it, he had his lab packed up. He couldn't get to his data, and he was fired on the spot. And he actually, I'll tell you, and he tells his story in a movie called Scientist Under Attack. He had a heart attack several months later. No, I'm sure no surprise there. And then he went on to tell his story of what happened to him. And he later published further about his research. I don't know, somehow he had access to this. So, okay. So now we have the setting that there are issues with that process of genetic modification, and we can go into this further if you like. And so if you fast forward to January 2017 to the work of Michael Antonio and his colleagues out of King's College in London, he also looked at the GM process. Is it the genetic modification process? And he looked at rats, and he studied the effect of the GM process on these rats. And he also found issues using cutting-edge technology called metabolomics, omics studies, and he looked at the genomics, the proteomics, the metabolomics, and he found several interesting things. That he found that there was significant oxidative stress from this process. He also found higher levels of chemicals, of molecules called polyamines, putrescine and cadaverine, I believe, which are ubiquitous in our body, but in high levels are tumor-producing or cancer-producing, and that's our concern about, one of our concerns about, you know, the genetic modification process among many. And he also found relationships to histamine release and allergenicity. So that is just one aspect of the GM process forwarding from 1998, I think the study was actually published, to Dr. Antonio's work that, again, we replicated, you know, in a couple of other studies in between there as well by Dr. Seralini, that there is a problem with the process without the associated pesticides. Did I answer your question, Gary, on that point?
Yes, you did. I'm not familiar with the documentary Scientists Under Attack. I'm going to take a look at that. I also, how can I put this? In the last 2 days, our research team has identified the single individual responsible for Big Pharma's constant troll attacks against all physicians, scientists, nutritionists, journalists, anyone who attacks GMOs, anyone who attacks vaccines, anyone who attacks drugs. They're themselves attacked on Wikipedia and other sources. And now we know who it is. We have actually identified this. And now we are going on the offensive. So there will be some justice in the near future for those who thought that they could attack with impunity the reputations and the good science of people trying to save lives. That said, we'll let that go for now. I can't say any more on it. You raised the issue. You have found it. Yeah.
Thank you.
We're going to nail these people, including, by the way, did you hear that I had her on the show. She got a death threat, Susan Humphreys. And I was told someone cut her brakes in her car. They play dirty. There's no level that they will not stoop to stop critics from bringing us the truth. In any case, you raise the issue you have found in your practice of children having comorbidity. Now, I don't know how many people in this audience know the term, so explain the term and also the role of your gut's microbiome playing in the development of this condition.
Certainly, comorbidity of more than one health issues together. So rather than just having one health issue, there is a multiplicitude of health issues that are kind of related, and we call them comorbidities, and things are linked to other things. So this idea that that this body is a series of organs, as we practice in Western medicine, is inaccurate. So our entire premise of how we practice needs to be rethought out and reorganized the way we practice it in integrative or functional medicine. It's what naturopaths do, many chiropractors, many functional MDs practice as biological systems, that we are an interrelated group of an organism of mind, body, and spirit. And that's how you have to treat people as a holistic being, not as a series of diseased organs. So we have to move from that concept. And we do address it in the book, and Dr. Adams and I present this concept of eco-medicine, not our term, but bringing forth this idea that we have to readdress how we look at our health. And as you have said in so many of your shows, Gary, as preventative and not treatment-oriented. Once you're starting to do treatment, it's not too late, but preventative is where we need to get to. So the microbiome concept and the Human Microbiome Project and literature on this subject has exploded. We've known for millennia that the microbiome, those organisms that compose your everything from your mouth to your bottom, your tush, are key to the function of our bodies, our biologic systems. We have evolved with our microbiome, and actually, we are mostly microbial in composition. Many of us have way more microbes than human cells, maybe some of us 10-to-1 ratio. Now, there are individual variances, but we are more microbial in nature. These organisms are not there by chance. They are specifically there, acquired through the passage of the birth canal when babies are born from mom, and that microbiome that it's now identified as an organ in itself has a multitude of functions. And one of the key things it does after birth is it talks to the thymus and is responsible for triggering something called innate immunity. It's one of the immunological systems we have in our body. We have innate and adaptive immunity. And this is a key part of immune function. And so if that microbiome is disturbed for any reason, already at birth, infants are impaired on their ability for their immune system to trigger. Now, hopefully they're nursed because the breast milk is rich with microbiome, with the microbiota and organisms as well, and babies can replete their microbiome. After 2 years old, we cannot replete our microbiome, by the way. It becomes very challenging to do that, and that's a little bit of a sidebar. So we now know that specific alterations in that microbiome and that organ profile is related to specific diseases. So, for example, we now know that if you have diabetes, you may have an organism in your gut called Akkermansia. We know that Proteus might be associated with rheumatoid arthritis. We know that children with autistic spectrum disorder have a high rate of an organism of Clostridial species. So this we call in the book this dysbiosis, or an imbalance of the microbiome. And so this organ, these little players in our guts, are not only responsible for this immune modulation, but they're also responsible for the production of neurotransmitters, and we can get into this and why that's so important, the chemicals that run your brain function, detoxification from toxins and toxicants, also very important, and they produce certain vitamins, key vitamins like vitamin B12 and folate, which are very deficient in many sick individuals who have complex chronic disease. That's just to give you a little bit of what they do, among other things. Now, what people may not know, that glyphosate, the main ingredient Roundup, which is in just about everything we eat unless you're eating organic, was patented by Monsanto as an antibiotic, a broad-spectrum antibiotic at that. So how much of the microbiome it wipes out every time you eat that slice of pizza that is not organic, how much of your microbiome it wipes out? No idea. It's not been looked at. We have very little data on that microbiome issue and glyphosate in terms of its antimicrobial effects. Forget all the other things that glyphosate does, because it does a lot of things. But we're just focusing on the microbiome right now. So that is one of, if you just took that one issue with glyphosate alone, that right there, that should be raising alarm bells and flags, because I think probiotics and the microbiome is pretty now well accepted among all classes of medical practitioners, not just integrative, but Western docs as well. So this is just, I'll keep it short. I know we don't have tons of time here, Gary, but that just gives you an idea of the role of the microbiome and the effect by glyphosate, for example.
Good. We're out of time, Michelle, but what I want to do is invite you back for a full hour on our Progressive Commentary Hour to discuss this in really great depth. You've whetted our appetite, and we'll look forward to that discussion.
Thank you so much.
And I'll have Richard Gale call you to see if you're available this week.
Absolutely, and I appreciate your show and what you're doing. Thank you.
All the best. Dr. Michelle Perreault, P-E-R-R-O. And she is the author of What's Making Your Children Sick. We will have her back this coming Tuesday on the Progressive Commentary Hour for the full hour to discuss this in depth. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.